So the first scripture reading is from the book of 2 Samuel, chapter 11, verses 1 through 15, and let us listen for God's word. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab with his officers and all Israel with him. They ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. But David remained at Jerusalem. It happened late one afternoon when David rose from his couch and was walking about on the roof of the king's house. He saw from the roof a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful. David sent someone to inquire about the woman. It was reported, "This is Bathsheba, daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite." So David sent messengers to get her, and she came to him, and he lay with her. Now she was purifying herself after her period. Then she returned to her house. The woman conceived, and she sent and told David, "I am pregnant." So David sent word to Joab, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." And Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked how Joab and the people fared and how the war was going. Then David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house and wash your feet." Uriah went out of the king's house, and there followed him a present from the king. But Uriah slept at the entrance of the king's house with all the servants of his lord and did not go down to his house. When they told David, Uriah did not go to his house, David said to Uriah, "You have just come from a journey. Why did you not go down to your house?" Uriah said to David, "The ark of Israel and Judah remain in booths, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do such a thing." Then David said to Uriah, "Remain here today also, and tomorrow I will send you back." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day. On the next day, David invited him to eat and drink in his presence and made him drunk. And in the evening, he went out to lie on his couch with the servants of his lord, but he did not go down to his house. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. In the letter, he wrote, "Set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting and then draw back from him so that he may be struck down and die." And the gospel is from John's gospel in chapter 6, verses 1 through 21. After this, Jesus went to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, also called the Sea of Tiberias. A large crowd kept following him because they saw the signs that he was doing for the sick. Jesus went up the mountain and sat down there with his disciples. Now the Passover, the festival of the Jews, was near. When he looked up and saw a large crowd coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread for these people to eat?" He said this to test him, for he himself knew what he was going to do. Philip answered him, 6 months' wages would not buy enough bread for each of them to get a little." One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. But what are they among so many people?" Jesus said, "Make the people sit down." Now there was a great deal of grass in the place, so they sat down, about 5,000 in all. Then Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, so also the fish, as much as they wanted. When they were satisfied, he told his disciples, "Gather up the fragments left over so that nothing may be lost." So they gathered them up, and from the fragments of the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten, they filled 12 baskets. When the people saw the sign that he had done, they began to say, "This is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world." When Jesus realized that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, he withdrew again to the mountain by himself. When evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into a boat, and started across the sea to Capernaum. It was now dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them. The sea became rough because a strong wind was blowing. When they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and coming near the boat, and they were terrified. But he said to them, "It is I. Do not be afraid." Then they wanted to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat reached the land toward which they were going. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. So I'm calling this sermon A Tale of Two Kings. So the first king, David, took what he wanted because he was king and he could. And when it didn't turn out exactly the way he wanted, he tried to cover it up and eventually had Uriah killed again because he could. He was king. So this is a very common tale where particularly those of us who are fortunate enough to have power use power for the self. And when I say the self, I don't even know if it's really the self. It's for whatever impulse is king in the self for the moment. A great spiritual teacher by the name of Gurdjieff says, if you pay attention, you'll notice there's not one solid self inside of us. You know, there are all these different pieces of us that claim the throne of ourselves at any given moment until the next king of ourselves arrives. Try that on this week and watch and see which self is running and calling the shots at any particular time. And so you think about this tale, right, of using power for what purpose? And in David's case, it's just the purpose of an instinct, of a desire for personal gratification. Power used in a way that dehumanizes both the self and others. But we have a tale of another king, King Jesus. And Jesus he wanted nothing to do with being a king. He wanted nothing to do with earthly power. He, we might say, avoided earthly power like the plague. But of course, I saw on social media the other day that we can't even use that expression anymore, avoiding it like the plague, because we seem not to be avoiding it. That's an aside. I'll go on. So why did Jesus have such an aversion to being king, to having earthly power? And I think the only answer that makes sense to me is because Jesus saw things that we just don't see. Jesus saw the reality of the spiritual dimension and the riches there that are beyond our imagination. And he was devoting himself to those riches and to helping people like us see and access that source of energy and power. So most of us are familiar. We've heard these two miracle stories that we read, that I read in John's gospel. There's a crowd that's coming, 5,000 plus. And Jesus asks Philip, you know, where are we going to buy enough food for all these people? And the text says that he said this to test Philip, that he knew exactly what he was going to do. So why the test? And again, the only explanation that makes sense to me is that Jesus was a spiritual teacher, and his desire was to wake all of us up to the reality of the spiritual dimension until we develop the capacity to actually see it and experience it and to live by it at all times. You might say that the entirety of our lives is a test, that we might be able to wake up to this spiritual dimension and begin to run our lives, steer our lives by its energy, by its power. And what this story tells us is that even though we have a hard time seeing the resources of the spiritual dimension, that those resources are there, and that they are always coming to us. God is much more anxious to give than we are to receive. And you'll notice that in John's gospel, every one of the miracles is called a sign. Did you catch that? It's a sign. So the idea is that we are not supposed to put all of our attention on the sign, but we're supposed to focus on what it is that the sign is pointing to, that something greater than the sign is pointing to. And of course, we usually get this all wrong. We focus on the miracles themselves. In this instance, the multiplication of the loaves and the fish. But for John's gospel, it's the sign of a spiritual reality trying to tell us, taste and see that there is abundance always coming to us, that there is nothing really in this world that we have to fear, that God will provide for us everything that we need. It may not be what we want, it may not be what we think we need, but in every given moment, God is providing for our well-being. Now, John's gospel understands that this is not easy for us human beings to see. And understandably, we're human. Our attention goes to our inadequacy. It goes to the impossibility of our circumstances. And it seems that the Gospels are trying to tell us that the only way we can learn of the truth of the spiritual dimension is if we develop the ability to experience that dimension in the constrictions and limitations of our physical earthly existence. It's the only way. So, how do I illustrate this? Well, this week I had a couple of meetings with people who are planning memorial services. A former member I did not know, had not met, at a small funeral later in August. And the other was with really good friends, Bob and Deb Sparling, as we met this week for the first time to talk about the memorial service for Jane Murphy. And it was so interesting. As we began to talk, really for the first time, Jane's death began to become real for me personally and powerful. You know, it's like it's an idea, but it begins to become real when you begin to say, okay, we're gonna create you know, her memorial, and you begin to imagine what that is going to be like. And, you know, but of course, because Bob and Deb are such good friends, I didn't feel like I had to be totally in my ministerial persona. You know, I could be John as much as I could be, you know, Pastor John. And so the conversation flowed easily. And I found myself saying to them, you know, this maybe sounds strange, but I have to tell you that funerals have become, I think, my favorite part of ministry. And I know that sounds weird, but the reason I say that is I feel like at funerals, we touch into the spiritual more deeply than in any other aspect of the life of the church. The heart is open. The personality structure is softened. And we're less in our heads. We're less in a defensive posture. We're less in a kind of a projection of an image of ourselves. And we're just present to the depths of life, the inexplicable reality of death that we know in our minds is real, but always takes us to another place when it hits close to home. And I find in those moments a certain clarity coming about really what the significance of our lives is about. And it becomes really clear in ways that it's not clear most of the time. It's about love. It's about relationships that embody and help us realize the experience of that ethereal something that we call love, which we're told is the fundamental reality of the universe, but which most of the time in our day-to-day existence seems so, you know, removed, so unreal. But once we sink down into the depths and we open ourselves, we taste it. We know it in our bones. And it's why, for me, funerals are so significant. So, you know, we have that moment of clarity, right? And then we go about our lives and we forget and we fall asleep and we get sucked back into what I call trivial pursuits. You know, the things that our world tells us are so important, but at the moment of clarity, we know is not what our lives are about. We spend so much energy on things that frankly simply don't amount to a hill of beans. So in a strange way, is not this spiritual clarity, costly won, a true gift and blessing? We glimpse that just as we need food for our bodies, right? And most of the time we eat unconsciously. We're not aware of what we are taking in is life. Just as we need food and good food for our physical health, we also need food for our souls. And I think that's what this story is telling us. We need food for our souls. And that soul food, that food that really brings us spiritual life and clarity, frequently is not what we would expect. It comes to us in surprising ways. And in some strange way, we may find our hearts broken, but our souls fed at exactly the same time. So if we can taste this reality of the sacred and begin more and more to return our lives to that center, John's gospel is telling us that we'll begin to learn how to trust this mystery of grace, even when our circumstances seem absolutely hopeless. That can be personally, or that can be collectively. And this is really one of my primary spiritual practices right now, because when I look at our world from a level of my earthly existence, I would be in despair. We are hopelessly divided as a country right now. We cannot even agree on basic facts. And our usual strategies of trying to connect and to bring, resolution simply no longer work, right? When was the last time a meme on social media changed anyone's heart or mind, or any serious conversation even changes a heart or mind? And when I look at this, what it says to me is that we are in one of those periods of history where we are undergoing a major transition of consciousness. And of course, consciousness, to those of us still in the mental rational structure of consciousness, seems like just airy fairy. What's that? Well, what I believe is happening is that this mental rational structure of consciousness, which has predominated for us in the West for hundreds of years, is coming to an end. And a new structure is on the horizon, which is more whole. It will be more spiritual. It won't jettison the mental, but it will understand that the spiritual is front and center and must hold it all together, and that the mental and that the individual must somehow be tied into a higher, more whole energy. People are calling it integral. It's emerging, but it's not here. And so we find ourselves in this liminal space between two realities, between two structures of consciousness, two ways of seeing and being in the world. And what we're experiencing right now in the breakdown of the rational is the presence of the pre-rational or irrational. And this, we all know in our bones, is a very, very dangerous place to be. So one thing gives me hope, and that is the reality of the spiritual dimension and its ability to open the inner world of people in ways that we simply cannot anticipate. It's not easy for me to stay hopeful, but I have confidence that the spiritual dimension, breaking through our limitations and our impasses, will eventually bring us to a new place. So when we don't see the spiritual, when it's not real to us experientially, then the story of David is a story that all of us fall into in one way or another. And I don't know about you, but you read this story of David and you think, what in God's name happened to this guy? I mean, he was a spiritual person. He was a creative-hearted human being. And I think what the story is telling us is that only the spiritual dimension can fill the human heart. And when we're not in touch with that, there is a deep soul sickness that comes not only to David, but to all of us. And when you are in that place of separation or soul sickness, then the self is prone to this aching, nameless desire to be filled. And so he's probably bored. He saw Bathsheba. He took her Things didn't work out the way he wanted. He tried to cover it up. And then eventually he just wiped it out. Had Uriah killed. How soulless our lives can get, even for a talented and basically good-hearted person like David. And none of us are immune from the bad choices which come from soul sickness. So, you know, if we can see that's what's behind the irrationality and the craziness and the blindness and the denial that haunts us, then maybe our energy can begin to move from anger, which is an understandable emotion, to compassion. And if somehow we can manifest the compassionate heart of the divine, then maybe a different energy can begin to take hold. I know I'd like to be able to just have a plan, you know, deliver it and everything would be changed. So in the second miracle, once again, we read a story about Jesus walking on the sea. So this is a sign again. We focus on the miracle, but the miracle is a sign pointing to another reality, a greater reality, a deeper truth that we need to be able to see. To change our lives and change our situation. So what is this pointing to? What is this a sign of? And I talked about this several weeks ago. I think what it is a sign of is what some people call an instatic spiritual path as opposed to an ecstatic spiritual path. An ecstatic spiritual path is a path of kind of just letting go and ecstasy getting taken out of the self and the constraints of the self and the limitations of the self and all of the messiness and the fear of this earthly condition. And it's a path well traveled. We want to just sort of find something that'll take us away. It's why we're addicted to so many things, including entertainment, because we just want to be taken out of the problems of the self. But the instatic path is a path of being able somehow to find this greater I am presence in the midst of the storms of life. So Jesus is walking on the sea. He says, "It is I. Don't be afraid." Or, "I am. Don't be afraid. I am." So we look at that and we say, well, that, of course, Jesus could do this. But the whole point, this is a sign for us to discover the I am presence, which is within each one. The I am, that part of us, which is eternal and infinite and greater than these little narrative selves that we think we are. That part of us that is untouched by the neurosis of the narrative self because it's trying to make its way in all of these uncertainties and storms, and it just simply isn't up to the task. It is the spiritual in us that can see the spiritual in everything. And that is the true purpose of our lives, is to wake up to that. Some way to become I am presence in the world. So I'm noticing how I taste into that. And I'm noticing how I fall asleep to that over and over. And so I practice returning to that as much as I possibly can until one day I pray that it becomes stable in me, and in you. And then the new world begins. Maybe so. Amen.